For great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. When you need to know the truth, keep it on the Damian Richardson Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to the show on Wednesday, the 17th of May. Look, I just want to tell everybody right here and now how I identify, because it seems to be an important thing now, and you have to accept the way that people will tell you they identify. That's the only way to be considered a human being now, on anything less than that, and you're vilified as being anti-human on some level. So I just want to let everybody know, particularly people that probably aren't listening to this station, that I do not identify as an anti-vaxxer. I don't identify as an anti-vaxxer. So if you are there to continue to call me, persist on calling me an anti-vaxxer, then you'll be held accountable, I'm sure, with the vilification laws, the sort of vilification laws that I believe that I have on good authority from a parliamentarian themselves, who will remain nameless, of course, have told me they're being worked on at the moment in the Victorian Parliament, and they'll be presented later this year. So you can vilify people on the grounds of not accepting how they identify. So I'm sure that'd be the case when someone says, oh, that anti-vaxxer on TNT Radio, Richardson, nah, I'd never listen to him. He's an idiot. Well, you can't call me that anymore, because that's not how I identify. I identify as vaccine free or something like that. I haven't even told you how I'll necessarily identify yet. That's to be announced. I'll work that out. I'm going to consider exactly how I identify, and I will. But I certainly don't identify as an anti-vaxxer. But these laws are going to be a worry. They're going to be a worry for everybody, because ultimately there's things that people don't like about woke, and you can't deal with woke. You can't, you know, reason with woke and make a proposition for woke, because woke ultimately is about power. It wants to accrue itself power. And as soon as you make a deal with it somewhere, it'll shift and it'll insist that you have to shift with it. And it's an impossibility to continue to make those shifts. And a lot of people have felt that. And I think even the government and the corporations have felt that on this whole drag queen story time. People don't accept drag queen story time as being something that is good for their children as part of this push for diversity and inclusion, that their children should be kept separate from this. Now, you can't win the hearts and minds of the people, so instead you have to use the legal process to make it illegal not to accept those people in those circumstances, as would be the case if you were in a change room somewhere with your daughter. Not that I would be, but that, well, I could be. This is the whole point. I could be if I decided to identify that way. And if a mother's in there with her daughter and a man drops his towel, and then everything is still intact as far as his masculinity is concerned, as what you would think to the naked eye, of course, it would be vilification to say he wasn't a woman and didn't have right to be in that change room if he thought he was a she. There you go. Already I'm falling foul of the vilification law. So no one's going to accept that. No one's going to accept that in good faith. So what you have to do instead is pass legislation that makes it impossible for you not to accept it. And you might think that's crazy, but we've seen examples of it. We've seen examples where judges, politicians, parliamentarians, people of all walks and aspects of life refuse to tell you in good value what they actually think a woman is. And you can see what's coming. You can see they can't say that because they know they'll fall foul, they'll transgress what is woke. And as I say, woke is just the ability to accrue power to the individual. And denies any collective understanding, and denies the tradition that has come to accept. You know, I mean, I can't even believe I'm talking like this. I can't believe you have to say, oh, the tradition that would mean you would accept what a woman is. And yeah, we find ourselves in such an extraordinary circumstance. And also this COVID thing, like people would like the COVID to go away, I'm sure, but all these compensation claims. Now even the mainstream media are starting to report on compensation claims, again, pretending as if they had nothing to do with the fact that everybody felt like they were coerced into having to take the vaccine. Now a lot of people are being vaccine injured, and the media are saying, well, look at this, it's, all these claims, there's 2,000 in process at the moment. A man was recently paid $2.2 million because of a neurological response he had to, I believe it was the AstraZeneca vaccine, but it's all of them, to the point where the man can't work anymore. He can't walk. And now there was a guy, a young guy, 21-year-old in New South Wales, who was blinded by taking the vaccine. There's two medical professionals to say that was the case, but the government haven't accepted his claim They have not accepted that he was vaccine injured. So what's that man supposed to do now? But again, the mainstream media are just reporting on it as if, oh, well, we nothing to see here. This is just what's happening in the world at the moment, but with no accountability whatsoever. At what point then do people who refuse to take the vaccine and suffered economic consequences because of that? Because I know this, I've got debtors. I've got lots of debtors that want me to pay them for 2 years of having not worked. If you don't work for 2 years because of a mandate that's ultimately enforced by the governments and the corporations, you tend to fall behind economically. So at what point can we even begin to make a claim against the state for the hardship that we've endured, the economic penalty that we've suffered from the choices we made, choices that are obviously were in our best interest? There's going to be a plethora of claims made, and of course they'll all be made against the state. So the taxpayer will fund the rollout of this vaccination process, and we'll also fund the claims made against the rollout. But why won't the pharmaceutical companies ever be held to account? Why do they get away scot-free? Why won't they be held to account for the amount, the transfer of wealth that was extraordinary, the transfer of wealth that occurred in this period like has never, ever occurred before? So that's my little rant to start off this Wednesday, the 17th of May. Hope you enjoyed it. But keep listening, of course, to TNT Radio.
Be a part of the conversation.
I want representation I can trust.
Have your say.
Biden isn't doing enough.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
My first guest this hour, as great pleasure, I get to introduce Professor Ian Bright Hope. He is a retired medical practitioner with over 40 years of experience. He now works with alternative medicines and other ways to ensure the health of the population. Professor Bright Hope, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Damien. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, no, you're more than welcome. It's great to have you here. Now, before I go to, before we talk to the interview, I just want to go to a clip I've got. I was talking about claims in my editorial. People are making claims now against the state for injuries they've occurred. And I've got a clip here. This is Chris Nemeth is more than one of 3,000 people claiming COVID vaccines made them ill. And here's what Jackie Quist, a Seven News reporter, reported about 8 days ago.
Back on his feet after a harrowing ordeal.
All I did was go and take a vaccine.
Now Chris Nemeth is fighting for justice.
I couldn't walk, I couldn't work.
The once healthy 49-year-old became wheelchair-bound after developing a chronic neurological disorder called CIDP. He says the symptoms began 2 weeks after having his first AstraZeneca vaccination in 2021. They included headaches, tingling fingers, facial palsy, and stolen mobility.
I was paralysed completely from the waist down.
Mr. Nemeth is still unwell and claiming millions of dollars in compensation under the federal government's COVID-19 vaccine claim scheme. He's one of more than 3,000 unlucky Australians maintaining COVID vaccines made them ill.
We've just had a settlement of $2.2 million for a very deserving applicant.
Tanya Nielsen is helping 100 injured Australians claim for rare but recognised vaccine side effects, like heart issues from the Pfizer vaccine and Guillain-Barre syndrome from AstraZeneca.
Over 12 months in which to get an outcome. And these are applicants who might not be able to work, so they don't have an income.
So far, the claim scheme has paid 147 people $7.7 million, with more than 2,000 applications in progress.
So, Professor Bright, we see there this cost the Australian taxpayer $7.7 million, and as if you could deny these people the compensation they need for their injuries. But the rollout cost us all this money as well. All of this was ultimately preventable, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, Damien. Right from the start, it was preventable. Gigi Foster has announced, and she's an economist who I have a lot of respect for, that this management of the COVID and the pandemic has cost us $500 billion, $500 billion. It's a lot of money. And let me say, the damage that's been done by the lockdowns and the vaccines and the management of patients in hospital is going to go on for years. and I believe possibly into the next generation. The $7.7 million that's been paid out so far is a drop in the ocean compared to what is going to happen into the future because of the mismanagement. And the cowboy approach to healthcare in this country and in other Western countries as well.
What are the compromises that have been made for the future, Professor?
The compromises made for the future, I'll give you an example. We knew that at the beginning of the pandemic, and even during SARS and bird flu, swine flu, and other epidemic influenza times, that a deficiency or low level of vitamin D in the system means you're going to get infected. The lower the level of vitamin D, the more severe the infection. And if it's very deficient, you end up dying from the influenza, from the virus. Vitamin D is the most important and profound preventative measure that we have for acute, severe respiratory viral illnesses. At the beginning of the pandemic, I wrote to the Prime Minister, the Health Minister, the Chief Medical Officer, the AMA, the RACGP, about instituting or executing a vitamin D campaign. Measure the vitamin D in your patients, bring it up to a level that's going to protect against infection, and by doing so, allow the virus to infect as many people as possible so that we would have the most profound and long-lasting immunity called natural immunity, where we actually produce antibodies in the mucus that prevent the virus from even getting into our system. I was ignored completely. And the consequence, we went into an epidemic or pandemic with a population low or deficient in vitamin D, especially in the elderly and also in those with comorbidities such as diabetes, metabolic syndrome, and autoimmune diseases. These people are deficient or low in vitamin D, and of course they're going to get infected and the infections are going to be severe. But the virus was not toxic. It was not a killer virus for the majority of the population. For the majority of the population, you get no symptoms or the symptoms of a mild cold or mild flu-like illness. So what we've done is allow a large percentage of the population to end up being vaccinated. A percentage of that population is going to be deficient in vitamin D. Both the vaccine and the vitamin D are going to suppress the immune system. Vitamin D deficiency will suppress the immune system even more so that when you get the virus, it's going to rip through your system and cause severe illness. But not only that, Damien, by getting this particular virus plus the vaccine, which contains not only RNA, but it contains parts of DNA from the original manufacturing process, means it's basically a genetic therapy. And we don't know what this DNA in the long run is going to do, because the lipid nanoparticles in which the mRNA is engulfed, embedded, contain the DNA. It contains other materials as well. Is carried to every system in the body, including the brain and the skull and the ovaries and the testicles, etc. Everybody knows about this now. So we are going to be facing a toxic problem, not only a toxic problem, but a genotoxic problem, and something that will possibly and probably, if one understands epigenetics, carry over into the next generation.
I was just going to say, I know you're a doctor, but when will people actually be held to account for what you're describing?
I believe they will be. There's certainly actions occurring. There are plans for further actions, legal action I'm talking about, both here and in the US and in Europe. There are going to have to be courts established that will hear these legal cases. Courts that are not biased, courts that don't have judges that are influenced by government, as has been the case to date. There will be people held to account, found guilty of misfeasance, malfeasance, and perhaps criminal offences. I mean, we know that Dr. Fauci in the US led the whole world with regard to this, and he actually committed crimes against humanity, as far as I'm concerned. Releasing,
Professor, I just want to ask you something, and this is an impossible question to answer, maybe in some respects, but you say there'll be people without bias, but everyone is implicated by the system they serve, aren't they, ultimately? So how could you even expect the system to actually find against itself?
I think the system will have to reform itself in many respects, and that is both from a medical perspective, a scientific perspective, and also from a legal perspective. We will need to select people in the future to become judges who are not biased by the establishment. Let me tell you, I had a case myself where the Victorian Medical Board attempted to strike me off. Mm-hmm. And if they'd succeeded with any one of the charges, in fact, there were charges for speaking to the media about how to treat cancer patients and HIV/AIDS patients with diet and nutrients and high doses of intravenous vitamin C. If I'd been found guilty of any one of the many, many charges of infamous conduct, I would have been struck off. However, they couldn't strike me off on the basis of what they said was advertising by speaking to the media and writing articles. So they punished me, and I appealed to the Supreme Court, and my barrister, my QC, who presented my case and the appeal to the Supreme Court, told me, Ian, you're very lucky you've got a judge who has not been brought up by the establishment. You've got a judge who is an immigrant into this country, and a judge who is an Italian immigrant, and who is aware of the establishment's bias. So it was Justice Gobbo, James Gobbo, who became the mm-hmm. governor of Victoria. So I was very fortunate. I got a judge who saw right and the ethics and moral approach that I was taking to helping patients with terminal illnesses, doing something that was out of the ordinary. So we have to reform our systems. And that's what I've been trying to do all my career, Damien, is reform medicine, so it's actually making people healthier rather than just treating diseases.
I'm talking to Professor Ian Brighthope about the COVID response and his alternative treatments for how to deal with respiratory illnesses. We'll go to a break and we'll be back to continue this conversation. You're listening to TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Fox, how's that firing Tucker working out for you?
Only 90,000 people in their key demographic still watch Fox during Tucker's 8 o'clock slot.
Folks, Tucker had 3.3 million people watching. He had over a million people in that key 24 to 54 demographic.
Megyn Kelly, the girl that went to elementary school just down the street here in Syracuse, New York, put it best when she dubbed Fox Foxweiser. Have we ever seen two more magnificent self-immolations than Anheuser-Busch and Fox News Corporation? In both instances, it's irreparable. This isn't like O'Reilly's firing, okay? Because O'Reilly, they laid the groundwork, they had a drip campaign of whispers and innuendos and allegations. There was nothing against Tucker. All of a sudden, bam, you're gone. People have had enough. We're finally voting with our feet, voting with our wallets, and Fox News is dead.
The Reckoning with Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds, and they do it by the types of hosts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis, by suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor one online music service over another and one candidate over another.
Google and Facebook
has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line. And the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The creepy line at salemnow.com.
The conversation continues.
It's ridiculous what we've allowed this group of politicians to lead us.
What the hell's going on in our country?
This is today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
We're talking to Professor Ian Brighthope, a retired medical practitioner, about the COVID response. Professor, you were saying before the break that you had to appear before Justice Gobbo because you were taken to court by the Victorian Medical Board. So you really had to run the gauntlet. Most people can't afford to do that, or they don't even necessarily have the wherewithal to do that. So it's a difficult proposition. And like you said, you were lucky. If you had had a different justice that was in the hand of the government, as so many justices are, as they're appointed by government, then you wouldn't have had that favourable outcome. We potentially wouldn't be having this conversation right now as a result.
Precisely, Damien. Let me just correct one thing about myself. I did retire, but I'm back on board again doing research and teaching, training doctors and nurses how to manage COVID, long COVID, and vaccination reactions, because that's been my whole life in terms of nutritional medicine. So I'm very active again and very, very concerned about what's happening. Yes, I was very fortunate. I did have enough. It was an appeal to the Supreme Court. It cost me a lot of money, but after the case, a benefactor gave me, and this is 1988, $250,000 to continue with research in nutritional medicine and cancer. So you have your ups and downs in life. My ups and downs have been pretty significant the last 3 years, trying to get change with regard to using the best of science and the best of health science to apply to individuals so that the government is more concerned about population, so-called population health, and that therein lies the one size fits all for everybody, lockdowns and vaccines. Whereas my approach is the doctors should be practicing medicine and not practicing protocols. Practicing medicine so that all of their patients are optimally nourished with regard to vitamin D and a couple of other things as well if they need them, and go into a pandemic where you actually fight off the virus. Because if you're vitamin D deficient, you go into a pandemic, you get sick, you've got serious complications because the deficiencies of nutrients, not only vitamin D, but many, many others, and you end up getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And that's why we're now seeing so many people with long COVID and long COVID-related diseases.
Professor, you're saying, so you faced a dark period and went through a road of trials, and then often hope is restored because people came and restored your hope in humanity as a result. And now you also say that you're teaching again at research and nutritional medicine. Whereabouts are you doing that? Because I can't imagine too many institutions of the state saying, you know, come here, Professor Brighthope, we'd really love to have you teach students.
No, I don't think any of the conservative institutions that are sponsored by industry directly or indirectly would welcome me at all. No, I decided I would set up another organisation. I was doing it by myself, but we set up an organisation called the World of Wellness International. We are an international organisation linked up with the World Council for Health and all of the organisations associated with the WCH. So we established the World of Wellness, and I retraining doctors and nurses to look after patients with long COVID and spike disease and long spike disease and, you know, the vaccination related disorders. It's been very busy, and we are looking at doing further training, continuing our training, and providing practitioners for clinics that open to the use of nutraceuticals and change in diet and other substances that we know help these unfortunate patients who have been damaged and severely damaged, some of them, by this poisonous injection. It's an experiment, and they should have one of the most important things from the Nuremberg trials post the Second World War and the trials of the Nazis and the Nazi doctors, that no person should be involved in any human experimentation without having full and informed consent. And they should understand what that information is, not just be informed, but they should be fully comprehensive in terms of their consent to whatever they're being given. This wasn't applied during this pandemic because what we did was we rushed into it with vaccines when we should have slowly at the beginning protected the individuals in the community with vitamin D. We actually tried to get into the nursing homes and measure the vitamin D levels in our nursing home patients here. We were refused, the medical people refused entry to do that, which is to me a form of corruption, because we had to go to Turkey to do a study. It was a study that based on the use of vitamin C, D and zinc, azithromycin, and one or two other agents, which we showed quite clearly that if you were low in vitamin D, you were admitted to hospital. If you were deficient in vitamin D, you were very sick, ended up in intensive care and possibly dying. The other thing was, if you were in intensive care and you were given high doses of intravenous vitamin C, the virus was killed, the inflammation was shut down, and you were out of intensive care very, very quickly. Now, the intensive care units here in Australia that I've had anything to do with have point blank refused to give dying patients high doses of intravenous vitamin C. They prefer to let them die and follow protocols rather than look after their patients. This, to me, is not only unethical, it's immoral. And it's a crime committed by my profession that I've always been very proud of, and doctors, individual doctors, I'm extremely proud of. We've got the best in the world when we do something right. But when we do something wrong, it's a catastrophe.
I feel the same as you with my profession, the media profession or the acting profession. They did all sold their souls too for exactly the same cause. We're talking to Professor Ian Brighthope. We'll go to news and we'll be straight back to continue the conversation. You're listening to TNT Radio.
I got a news flash for you.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. The leaders of six African countries are set to fly to Russia and Ukraine to help the warring sides reach a peaceful solution and hopefully bring an end to the conflict. There are warnings the world could be thrown into a state of panic within weeks if US Congress fails to strike a deal to raise America's debt ceiling. And Ukraine says Russia has carried out a series of exceptional airstrikes on Kyiv, with the capital bombarded with attack drones and both cruise and ballistic missiles.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Professor, you're talking about working for an organization called World of Wellness. So you can find that online. Just put in the coordinates, World of Wellness. You're hosting an event tonight too, actually, at the Cheltenham Bowls Club, which is at 2A Wilson Street, Cheltenham. That's tonight, Wednesday, May the 17th, 7 p.m. for a 7:30 start. Just $5 to get in. And I know the professor will be there. What could people expect if they decided to go to this World of Wellness event tonight in Cheltenham at the Cheltenham Bowls Club, Professor?
Well, I hope to be able to tell them the truth about what's been going on for the last 3 years. And I hope that there are a lot of questions about what they can do to help themselves, to help their families, to help others and relatives and friends who've been harmed either by the virus, which is only harming people if they've been vaccinated, or the direct effects of the vaccines. And you mentioned, was mentioned by Tanya, I think it was Tanya Milson earlier, that the common things were heart disorders, pericarditis, myocarditis, Guillain-Barre syndrome, which is a form of paralysis with severe pain. But there are many, many other presentations, bizarre presentations, such as tinnitus and headaches, migraine, the sudden onset of new cancers, and the acceleration of old cancers. This is a serious problem because it means the immune system has been very seriously damaged by the vaccination program. And this has to be acknowledged. It's got to be acknowledged. We cannot keep on going and listening to the statistics coming out that so many people are getting this, that, and the other disease, and people are dropping dead or getting very seriously ill from heart disease, especially young people in their teenagers. It's unbelievable what is happening and what's being ignored. And the deniers in the community have to wake up to what's going on. We cannot have an 18 to 20% increase in mortality over above expected and not talk about it and not examine it and not find out what's going wrong. We also need to have some research done to find out exactly what the spike protein is doing to the inside linings of all of our blood vessels, which supply every organ and tissue in the body, including the eye. And therein lies the problem with somebody who may have been blinded and the vaccine not being acknowledged as the cause of it, which is nonsense. I mean, as doctors, we're trained to think and act in terms of disease and be able to monitor patients with disease and actually be able to diagnose disease and determine the cause of the problem. And somebody is made ill after having a vaccine and they die the next day, that's one person. If they're made ill after having a vaccine and they don't die the next day, but they have been unwell for weeks and then they develop a serious disease, one has to be suspicious of the vaccine causing the problem. And this is what personalized medicine is all about. I'm not interested in populations. That can be the business of the bureaucrats, the health bureaucrats and the politicians, who basically want to be able to say, oh, we did the right thing. Everybody did the right thing. But it was really, from an individualized perspective, the wrong thing. So does that help, Damien?
Is that an advanced care directive? Is that what you're talking about, Professor?
Yes. I'm talking about – also, I'm talking about – sorry.
Yeah, keep going.
I'm talking about personalized, predictive, preventative healthcare. I'm in the middle of writing an article at the moment about definitions, so that we can be clear about what doctors are meant to do and what doctors cannot do, simply in the context of a healthcare system, which is basically dominated by doctors, drugs, hospitals, disease and diagnoses, etc.
Is that what an advanced care directive would be if you had one of those drawn up? Can you explain to us what an advanced care directive is?
Oh, advanced care directive. I would like to have myself a very powerful computer to look at the human genome, determine exactly what switches genes on and off, and determine how we deliver those agents to the individual's genes, so that right from birth we know how to optimize a person's wellness, if you like, and prevent disease. So if you've got diseases for heart disease or diabetes, we know how we can actually feed that person right, exercise that person correctly, give that person the right sorts of mind-body medicine, if you like, anti-stress mechanisms, so that we optimize the expression of their genes for their life. So that they're like
that sort of centralization of data collection is going to cause a lot of concern to a lot of people in this era now, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But Gates and co. Are figuring it out, like one of our psychiatrists here tried to figure it out, say, look, we've got babies who look like they're going to get mental illness. Let's drug them up from the first year of life. Well, that's what the medical profession want to do. Gates, with his data collection, wants to be able to say, okay, you're now 18 months old. You've got risk of particular childhood illness like leukemia, so we'll put you on an anti-leukemia drug. Or you're 5 years old and you've got genes for asthma, so we're going to put you on anti-asthma medication, even if you're perfectly healthy. So that model is doomed to fail. It's doomed to make sure that the pharmaceutical industry booms into the future at the expense of everybody here on terra firma. We're not interested. My group of doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals are not interested in drug care. Acute interventive medicine is fantastic. That's when we do need drugs and surgery and radiotherapy, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But if I'm having a heart attack or acute asthma attack, I don't want to be preached at the bedside on admission to hospital about my diet. I probably need a stent or some intravenous cortisone or something else to to save my life and keep me alive, but I do want to know what to do for the rest of my life, rather than be told you can eat the standard Australian diet and you can go ahead and carry on with all of your bad habits. No, that's not the future. And I think it comes back to reform and reforming not only medicine and law, but also our education system, because we don't have very much information and education from schools about how we can self-manage at home. And that's one of the things that we're doing with the WOW, the World of Wellness, Damien. Mm-hmm. We're actually looking at courses for members of the public so that members of the public can learn how to look after themselves, like our grandmothers did and our mothers. My grandmother used to give us garlic in our sandwiches. You know, this is a European thing. You know, these days, you know, it goes on a pizza every now and again, but that's about all, or maybe into some salad. But and cod liver oil. I mean, the cod liver oil was given during the winter to stop the winter colds and flus. Why does it stop it? Because it's got a nice dose of vitamin A in it, which keeps our membranes intact, and vitamin D, which stimulates our immune system all the way through to the DNA in our immune cells. That's how the vitamin D works. So we want to say the sunlight vitamin comes from the sun. The light goes into our system, produces vitamin D. The light then goes into our genes and tells them what to do. It's fascinating. And this is real science. It's real, hardcore, basic science. It's not wait for a disease and prescribe a drug. No, it's very, very different. And the doctors who are awake to this sort of thing and come to the courses, the RN courses, well, the college I started 42 years ago is still training doctors and other healthcare professionals. And in fact, they've got a conference coming up at the end of July in Melbourne about long COVID. So it's going to be a very interesting conference because I
think where's that, doctor?
It's in Melbourne at the end of July, and if you'd like to make an announcement about it, it's www.acnem,
Australasian.
A-C-N-E-M.
A-C-N-E-M. A-C-N-E-M dot org. Okay. So people can get online and find out about that, as they can also go and see you today in a few hours' time at the conference for World of Wellness. As I said before, it's going to be at the Cheltenham Bowls Club, 2A Wilson Street, Cheltenham, tonight. Doors open at 7 p.m. It's $5 per person and 7:30 start. And you can hear Professor Ian Brighthope to discuss even more. There's so many other things I wanted to talk to you about, Professor, including some of the responses we saw to COVID. I talked to nurses who said that they, you know, someone had been married for 50 years. They couldn't actually, when one of the partners was dying, they had to stand behind a Perspex wall and talk to them on a phone to say how much they loved them because they actually couldn't be in the same room. And that, as much as anything else, destroyed the healthcare system, because that nurse who was a veteran had all that information left the system because she could not participate in it morally anymore.
Yes, yes, Damien, I fully understand, because most of the nurses who belong to the WOW have been in that situation. Mm. One was in charge of all of the nurses in a major city hospital in Melbourne, and she was dismissed because she just asked some questions about the safety of the vaccine. She was dismissed on the spot, and she'd been there for 30 years. Some of the stories that I hear from the nurses in particular, how people just know all the cardiac cases coming in, especially the young ones, are related to the vaccine, and nobody wants to talk about it. I find this extremely shameful. Why can't people face the truth? Why can't people talk about the issues around this? Why is the majority of the population just wanting to move on and forgetting about COVID? Well, if we move on and forget about COVID, it's going to hit us again. And it's going to possibly, when there is a severe viral illness, we won't have any protection at all, and we'll be locked down again, waiting for another mRNA vaccine, which is going to kill more people than save.
Professor Ian Brighthope, thanks so much for joining me on the Damien Richardson Show.
My pleasure, Damien. Thank you very much.
You're listening to TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Color me cynical, but my reaction to John Durham's report proving what we've said all along, that FBI is corrupt top to bottom, is ho-hum. The report, along with evidence of all the other Democrat crimes, like Benghazi, like Hillary's emails, like Russia Gate, like impeachment 1.0, impeachment 2.0, like stolen elections, like the raid on Mar-a-Lago, like Biden having 1,850 boxes of classified documents scattered hither and yon, which actually opens him up to criminal prosecution. Hunter's tax crimes, Hunter's gun crimes, Hunter's drug crimes, the Biden family money laundering crimes. They're all going to end up in the dustbin of history, ignored by all except perhaps some future historian who will finally conclude decades from now that yes, indeed, the American empire fell because of Democrat crime and corruption. For MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Nuclear power offers abundant, concentrated energy for the world, which is necessary to lift people out of poverty. Modern nuclear reactors are safe and provide power 24/7 without pollution. Today, the world is undergoing a nuclear power renaissance. As of March 2022, 56 large reactors are under construction worldwide in 17 countries. Planning approvals exist for 96 reactors, which are mostly expected to be in operation within the next 15 years. A further 325 reactors are proposed in 30 countries, with specific programs or sites. The Western media ignores this reality, as most of the planned and proposed reactors are for China, Russia, and India. While the United States has only 2 reactors under construction and 3 planned, China has 19 under construction and 34 planned.
The human mind is like a computer, no matter how efficient it may be. Its reliability is only as great as the information fed into it.
That's a campaign promise.
Tell us the truth. Tell us the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
You're hearing it.
TNT. So we're just talking to Professor Ian Brighthope, and I've got an update on an event that we're part of here and proudly bringing to you from TNT Radio, and that's the world-renowned cardiologist, public health campaigner and best-selling author, Dr. Asim Malhotra, will be touring Australia with the Australian Medical Professional Society, AMPS, sponsored by TNT Radio, beginning on May the 27th. And I know Professor Ian Brighthope's going to be part of that as well. The tour will cover several cities across the country, raising public awareness about vaccine injuries and providing a risk-benefit evidence-based analysis of the COVID vaccines, with special emphasis on cardiovascular complications and solutions. The tour is open to the public and will provide an opportunity to engage with Dr. Malhotra and other experts in the field, including Professor Ian Brighthope. For tickets and more information, visit amps.redunion.com.au. That is amps.redunion.com.au. Now, it is with great pleasure I bring on a show regular. He's made the migration to the earlier time slot. Might suit him better. Who knows? Us older boys, we need to get to bed earlier nowadays. So we've got this show in the middle of the day, specifically for Dr. Alan Moran. He's a principal of regulation economics and is a noted economist who has analysed and written extensively from a free market perspective. He has an article out in the latest Spectator talking about this lurch, of course, to renewables and what cost it is imposing on our retirement funds. Dr. Alan Moran, welcome to the show.
Hi, Damien.
Now, before we go into it, I've just got an audio clip I've got from another Alan, Alan Jones, who what he had to say yesterday on Chris Smith's show about the amount of copper it's going to be required to fulfill clean energy targets.
Now we've got this business about everything's going to be sold by renewables, and we're going to have, I mean, can you believe it, 22,500-watt solar panels installed every day for 8 years, 47-megawatt wind turbines every month 10,000 kilometres of additional transmission lines. Now, we don't know where they're going to be or whose properties they're going to go across. But then if you take the argument that, all right, OK, let's assume Bowen is correct and we're going to have these solar panels and wind farms and so on. Therefore, we'll need minerals to produce these products. Well, let me just tell you in relation to copper. Right, to make enough wind turbines, solar panels and batteries to replace fossil fuels for 20 years, the world would need over 4.5 billion tons of copper. That's just one mineral, 4.5 billion. The world currently mines 24 million tons of copper, not 4.5 billion. So it'll take 189 years to produce enough copper to get to net zero at the current rate of copper production.
Dr. Alan Moran, what could possibly go wrong?
An awful lot there. I mean, it is possible, or it's very likely, there's a lot more copper around. But what Alan Jones is really saying is that, yeah, if we are capable of mining it, it's going to be more and more marginal reserves, and the price of copper is going to go sky high, and that's going to add to the costs of this great renewable revolution which is being engineered.
It's transmission too is a problem, isn't it? Because you've got to transmit from that source. So if there's a solar panel out in the middle of a paddock somewhere, in some way you've got to transmit it. And if it's just intermittently producing energy too, so that means that infrastructure just sits there useless for long periods of time. But these are the sorts of things that are never factored into the equation as we lurch towards renewables, are they?
No, they're not. And indeed, well, we do know we're going to have three times as much transmission as we've already got. That's simply because the renewables are much much lighter and much less energy per gigawatt of capacity. In addition to that, because they are intermittent, we're going to have a hell of a lot of batteries, and we probably can't conceive of how we could do the 80-90% renewable target which Minister Bowen is talking about for 2030.
So Jim Chalmers' budget surplus is, $4.2 billion, but, and it's only a small surplus, but it's predicated, isn't it, off the back of the nation's resource assets?
Exactly. I mean, and this is one of the real key imponderables. Basically, what Chalmers is a big spending budget, but he's getting a lot of money coming in from the resources, which means basically, in addition to iron ore and copper maybe, coal, oil, and petroleum. And yet, these are the demonized products, and at every opportunity, the government seeks to prevent new developments, usually by making up specious arguments that, the coal mine is quite close to the Barrier Reef or whatever. So it is actually penalizing the very products which have in the past given us cheap energy, and which is giving the government coffers considerable amounts of money so it can increase its bragging rights about balancing the budget, quite fortuitously. Nothing to do with government policy. Indeed, the government policy is acting against it.
And I think we spoke a while ago, and we talked the idea that maybe Tanya Plibersek was knocking back mines in the Galilee Basin on the basis, obviously it was too close to the Barrier Reef, but ultimately underpinning that, we thought it was paying back a political opponent, Clive Palmer, who was obviously putting up the funds to build those mines. But that's not the case, is it? It's just a pure ideological standpoint. Now, it might have some political expediency at times, because she has knocked back proposals for two mines in Queensland, two coal mines, but Clive Palmer had nothing to do with them.
That's right. I mean, there is a strong ideological opposition, and they make up these ridiculous arguments that, oh, well, it's pretty close to the Barrier Reef. What they mean is it's like 10 miles from the coast or something, but like 100 kilometres away from the Barrier Reef, and couldn't possibly pose any harm to it. But these are arguments which you just sort of dreamed up, basically heart-tugging type arguments dreamed up to actually pursue what is really an ideological crusade against fossil fuels.
We can see that more and more, can't we? Because now they say there's going to be environmental harm caused to future generations. So we've heard all that before because of the emissions of CO2. But now they're singling out too, particularly it may cause harm to First Nations people.
Just ridiculous. I mean, that there's probably less harm to First Nations people simply because if they are First Nations and they're living in remote areas, then there's even less chance of that of any kind of adverse effect of greenhouse gases on those people. It's just basically they conjure up excuse after excuse to add to the plausibility of their what are basically just ideological crusades.
Do you think what they really want to do, Alan, is the secret is being unlocked there and they want to protect First Nations people? They want us all to go back to living how it was when we turned up in 1788, so we'd all be living the sort of life that tribal life that First Nations people were living when Western civilization got here in the first place.
Well, that would be the outcome for the vast majority of people, probably not the politicians who are cushioned from that because they can always grab money from society as a whole. But that would be the outcome, a severe decline in living standards if we were to actually suppress greenhouse gases or and prevent coal, oil and gas production in the to the extent which these politicians and, in fact, their green supporters to the extent that they desire it, and you know, it would be disastrous for our economy, and probably very harmful for individuals. It would certainly lower our living standards, perhaps to what they were 200 years ago.
And are you saying too? I noticed that towards the end of your article, it's a bit of a footnote in some respects, but it's important. That's the thing about the housing bubble and the effects that would have on superannuation funds, because the housing bubble looks like it's going to burst.
Yeah, and superannuation funds are hit in two ways because basically they are very much on the same bandwagon of anti-carbon, and in those funds, which is about half of the funds, who are on that bandwagon are making big losses. I mean, one of them has lost really 15%, 14-15% of their members' money. But in addition, they're very heavy in terms of property, and it's unlisted property. In other words, that when they say we've got this property and it's valued at this, this isn't an actual, this is an arbitrary value. It's not one measured in the stock exchange. So basically, some of these funds and CBIRS and HostPlus, et cetera, are very overweight in terms of their investments on property. And they reckon their property is going up in price. But we're looking around and we're seeing, property going down quite severely in price as a result of a lesser demand for offices and for various other things. We can see this in terms of the listed property trusts and in terms of, you know, indeed a bankruptcy in some of the housing market areas. It just isn't credible that these funds have been so successful that they've, in the face of a 20 or 30% reduction in the price of things, of property investments on the market, that they are actually seeing an increase in their own investments value. So I think there is a bit of a hiding we're going to take when all this comes to book, which it will eventually, and is revealed.
It doesn't make any sense, does it, ideologically, in a way? They talk about ideology all the time, or we do. At least it's about their ideology, because they want to bring in 750 million immigrants over the next 2 years. So that's going to increase demand for housing, so they might be able to cover that off. But it's also going to increase our emissions, isn't it?
Well, it will do that as well. It's 750,000, of course, new immigrants will in fact do all that adverse impact. But you know, I'm not against more immigration. But you know, you've got to actually accept if you have more immigration, you have more houses. You've got to find the jobs. You've got to find the energy. So on the one hand, they're kind of pulling more immigrants into the nation. On the other hand, they're actually shutting off the opportunities of those immigrants to increase or to live the sorts of lives that they want to live, because we are doubling down against energy. We're doubling down against, we're not allowing enough houses to be built. The one good policy the Liberals have at the present time is they say they're going to force the states to release more land to simplify land releases to allow cheaper housing. And I think that's to be applauded generally.
But what about the congestion as a result too? Because there's already so much congestion. I dropped my daughter off at school this morning. It took me, you know, I only had to go a couple of kilometres, but it took me at least 20 minutes to get back home because there's just so much traffic on the road because it's this medium density housing everywhere all of a sudden.
Well, that's true. And you basically, you know, we've got to be spending on roads. You know, there's no reason why we shouldn't have roads which are every bit as good as they are in Japan and elsewhere, which has got a, you know, much more dense population than we have. But you actually got to spend the money, and essentially a lot of the money which is being diverted into, you know, rail transport, which is useful, but really roads are the key to maneuverability and to transport solutions. And we're probably not spending enough as a nation on the roads. And as you say, the congestion is getting even worse and will get worse with more immigration.
But Japan's operating such a confined space compared to the vastness of this country, isn't it? I mean,
Yeah. I mean, you would hope that we spend as much money on roads as we collect in terms of road-specific taxes on petrol and on diesel and on general registration, but we actually don't. I mean, that just gets banked elsewhere or used for other log rolling measures that governments prefer to spend the money on.
We've got rolling. To keep up with that. Love it. Dr. Alan Moran, thanks so much for joining me on this earlier hour. You sound as sprightly as you did in the later hour.
Thanks, Damien. Good to talk.
Thanks, mate. Thanks, everybody else, too. Stay around for Christmas show. You're listening to TNT Radio.